Hello, today we're beginning the introduction to the Zohar. Introduction to the Zohar. Introduction to the Book of Zohar. In this introduction, I would like to clarify matters that are seemingly simple. Why are they simple? Matters that everyone fumbles with, everyone wants to deal with them, and which much ink has been spilled over in attempting to clarify. So many people wanted to clarify them, but not many understood because they're still trying. Yet we have not reached concrete and sufficient knowledge of them. And here are the questions. What is our essence? What is our role in the long chain of reality which we are but small links of? What is our essence is a question that the entire humanity has been dealing with, the greatest question. It encompasses our entire life, our entire existence. Also, if there's another existence besides our own that we don't know of, what is our role? That if there is some kind of a certain purpose that someone determined, so perhaps we must reach it through all kinds of observations, of operations. We see that humanity changes. You might say advancing, but at least it changes. So like all things in nature, humanity is a part of it. So is there a certain purpose to it, certain goal, a certain end to all the changes we go through? And the entire reality along with us is some kind of, is a single system, and we see ourselves small in reality on the one hand. On the other hand, judging by the evolution of the parts of reality, still vegetative, animate and speaking, we are the most advanced, most developed. So we're the smallest but the most developed. So speaking about a goal, the goal seems to be, if we judge by development, the goal must be us, and not some, I don't know, some small lumps of still substance that are just floating in space of our universe. And we are also, as we know, as we in the meantime see, we are the only ones that want to know the end and what we are for. When we examine ourselves, we find ourselves to be as corrupted and as low as can be. Although we are the highest of reality, but toward reality we are small and low. Why? Because we don't know what our essence, what our goal, what our role is, how we live, by which forces that activate us. And we don't run our lives, our existence, without knowing the beginning and the end. We don't know what happens every day, how it happens. So toward the entire universe, although we are the most developed, we're at the same time the lowest, because all of nature beside man exists with absolute fixed laws. They do not make mistakes and run their lives according to nature, according to instincts. And we keep making mistakes. We never understand what we do, and we are the only ones that corrupt nature and corrupt things around us and don't exist according to some clear laws or even unclear laws. Like some kind of an animal that is like out of control. It doesn't have any right regulation of behavior toward reality. That's us. And when we examine the worker who has conceived us, we are compelled to find him of utter praise. So we can speak from the point of perspective of the Kabbalists who already see the Creator. So of course it's like that once you find him. But if you judge compared to nature, the forces, the systems, the talent and skill that everything is done by, from the smallest particle to the entire reality that is interconnected and consists of innumerable details, and how everything is synchronized and behaves. In our nature, we understand maybe one part of a million of this reality. We understand even less. So when we discover nature as a very, very smart, clever system, special, how can it be that from the is it not necessary that from the perfect worker will come out only imperfect works? Yes, we are above animals, above the animate degree, where we are actually the speaking level. We are completely low and base. It's as though this is a part that nature did not create in us, but it's just done like that, the speaking part of us. Our mind tells us that he, meaning the general power that created reality, is utterly benevolent, beyond compare. This is true that any nature researcher reaches it, even not from the perspective of Kabbalist sources. Even just philosophers or scientists, they come to understand that the collective force is benevolent. How then did he create so many creatures? Now we're talking about still vegetative and animate and speaking, all of them that suffer and agonize all through their lives. Is it not the nature of the good to bestow, or at least not to harm so? Here we might talk about the entire creation already, because everyone suffers and everyone exists only in suffering, only to survive. They don't make mistakes like us. They live by instinct. They don't have to evolve. But they still suffer. So how can it be that from bad will come, from good will come out such good? How is it possible that the infinite with no beginning and no end will extract from itself finite mortal transient creatures? So it's not already that they just feel bad, but eternal means that this collective law of reality, the Creator has a completely different existence than our own, because our existence stems from being mortal, being transient, temporary. Everything just comes and goes and ends, and all our operations are in the end stem from the fact that there is an end before us, and we see it, and from that we make our calculations. Knowingly or not knowingly, we all take into consideration one moment, one thought. Soon it'll be over. And we don't understand how reality and life can be approached if we lived indefinitely. We don't understand that, but this is a completely different way to approach reality. So why did He create us transient? Is not not eternal. That's the question that the entire approach to living stems from. Item 2. I think that all of man's questions, primary questions, go into these five first questions. Perhaps we don't know where to relate questions that awaken in us, but in the end they're in here. Item 2. In order to clear all that up, we need to make some preliminary inquiries. And not, God forbid, what it is forbidden, meaning in His essence. Of which we have no conception whatsoever. So he says that directly we cannot approach these questions, we are incapable. We have to prepare some inquiries for that, to have some knowledge first, build some vessels for understanding, and then perhaps we can work it out, sort it out. But we will. And he says these inquiries can be in everything but the Creator Himself. And this is strange, because if He is the source of reality, so if I study Him, I understand everything. That's where everything comes from. He says no. And the Creator, yes, it would be good to study Him, and perhaps from there we could know everything. But it is forbidden to study Him. Why? Forbidden, a prohibition means impossibility, because there is no conception in Him whatsoever. Our thought, our conception cannot conceive Him. We have our own forces, and those are in a lesser degree than the Creator, the degree of a creature. And from the creature we cannot study the essence of the Creator, who He is, what He is. It is only done by philosophers, and that's why they come up with nothing, because there are two degrees, one below the other, and there cannot be an inquiry but only in the degree the heart and mind and senses are. That's why we have no conception of Him whatsoever. That's why we can't study Him. But if we don't study Him, can we really reach our essence, our role, etc.? Again, probably yes. Unless we have no thought of Him. But where the inquiry is required, meaning something that is desired, that is necessary, that without it we can't reach the understanding of our essence and of our goal, but remain low and transient. So what is that? Meaning an inquiry in His deeds. As the Torah tells us, know thou the God of thy father and serve Him. And as it says in the poem of unification, by your acts we know you. So if we examine, study the acts of the Creator, it will probably be enough for us to know everything we have to know about ourselves. And there will be no place, empty place left, that will require some fulfilling in understanding and knowledge. But all the questions that might arise in us will be answered by the study of the acts of the Creator, not the Creator Himself. Because we are consequences from Him. We begin from the creature level. And the creature is the act of the Creator. So if we study the acts of the Creator, we study everything about us, having left no questions. There cannot be another question in us about anything that we cannot cover by studying the acts of the Creator. And if it does awaken still about something that is outside it, it must be that by studying His acts we will also know even about Him. As it says, from your acts we know you. If after all these inquiries I have to know who he is, I will know that by studying His acts. Is it the same as studying Him? Probably so, yes. Because it says, know thou the God of thy father and serve Him. Your father is a higher degree. And not just the God of thy father. The God of thy father is the third degree above. There's me, there's my father, and the God of thy father. Higher than that. So he says, yes, we can reach that degree. If a person reaches the degree of gadlut, great adulthood, which is called a father, from that he can also acquire the God of thy father. These are the three degrees in atzilut that we have: Zon, Abavima, and Arichampin. So which inquiries do we inquire? Now with which inquiries we inquire the Creator, or not the Creator, but His deeds. Inquiry number one. It is all inquiry in His acts, yes, in a reality that is in us already or around us. Inquiry number one. How can we picture a new creation? Meaning something new that is not a part of Him before He created it. When it is obvious to anyone of right mind that there is nothing that is not a part of Him. Can one give what one does not have? Meaning, as according to our judgment, It is impossible that something is suddenly born or created from zero without any prior reason, without any prior situation, or maybe it was concealed and now it suddenly appeared. It's possible that the previous situation appeared in other ways or existed in other ways, like maybe gas changed to liquid and from liquid to solid, and solid can turn to liquid again and liquid to gas, and so on. But everything has something that precedes it. So a new thing is called something that did not have anything prior to it. How can anything like that be in reality? The mind does not agree with it. This cannot be happening. There has to be a thought, a decision that comes before. What was before this thought? Inquiry number two. If you say that from the aspect of His Almightiness, He certainly can create existence from existence, from absence, sorry. Meaning He created something from nothing, from something that He didn't need before, that was not needed before. Meaning something new that is not in Him. He didn't need it, He was not a part, it was not in Him. How can we say about the Creator that is which is complete and includes everything, that has something that there is something that is not in Him? There arises the question, what is this reality that can be conceived, which has no place in Him and is completely new, that He suddenly needs? If He suddenly needs it, then maybe he wasn't perfect before. Inquiry number three deals with what Kabbalists have said, that a man's soul is a part of God in such a way that there is no difference between him and the soul, but that he is the whole and the soul is the part. And they had compared it to a rock carved off a mountain. There's no difference between the rock and the mountain, except that he is a whole and the rock is a part. Thus, we must ask, a stone carved from the mountain is separated from it by an axe made for that purpose, causing the separation of the part from the whole. But how can you picture that about him, that he will separate a part of his essence to become separated from him, meaning a soul, meaning take even a different name, this part, to the point that it can only be understood as a part of his essence? He created some reality, some new reality, something new, by which he cuts off from himself parts. These parts are called souls, and on the one hand there is a part of the Creator here, and this is a part. How is it possible to cut pieces off of godliness? And why? How does he do it? Takes himself and cuts himself into little pieces. Each of them is called a soul. And there is no difference between him and these his parts, but these parts are separated only in being partial, being cut off by an axe, some spiritual axe. Inquiry number four. Since the chariot of the evil side and the shields are at the other end of His Holiness, that nothing farther remote can be conceived, how can it be extracted and made from holiness, much less that it will sustain it? So not only does the Creator cut pieces off and they become separated, meaning different somehow, far, but there are such parts that are called shells, sitra'achra, that are opposite to Him on the other end. At the other end. Yet all the parts, the near, the far, or the opposite, all these parts, He revives all these parts, sustains them, nurtures them, regardless of how far they or opposite they are to Him. This is also very, very unclear. How is it possible that He'll have connection with something that is opposite to Him, that is against Him, His nature? While we say that in spirituality, connection goes by equivalence of form. If something is opposite, it's got to be completely severed from holiness. And here we say that He revives everyone and sustains them and nurtures them. How is that possible? So there's not a complete incision, separation. So the Creator does have some connection with Sitra Achra, with shells. Connection meaning that He's got a part that is similar to them? How else would there be a connection? If not through some kind of common attributes. Inquiry number five, the matter of the rising of the dead. What is this thing? They say that it exists. Since the body is so despicable that immediately at birth it is doomed to perish and be buried. It talks about the will to receive, not about our bodies. There's not a question about our bodies. We see that they disintegrate and there's nothing left. It only becomes from animate to still when it dies. It talks about the will to receive that the Creator created, which is the body of the Parsuf, Guf. So it is so despicable that immediately at birth, meaning when it is created by the breaking of the of Adam HaRishon, takes the aim of to receive, then it is doomed to die and be buried. Those are the corrections that will to receive, to remove the aim to receive. Furthermore, the Zohar said that before the body rots entirely, the soul, meaning loses the intent to receive, the soul cannot ascend to its place in heaven. The light that is in this will to receive, called the soul, is certainly incapable of being in the degree of Garden of Eden, heaven, but only according to the correction of the will to receive in order to bestow, which is already the degree of Bina at least. It is called that it reaches the degree of the Garden of Eden, which is the degree of Bina in every partsuf, in every place. While there are still remnants of it, of the aim to receive, it is impossible that the soul will attain the degree of Bina, Garden of Eden, godly. Therefore, why must it return and rise at the revival of the dead if we completely remove ourselves from that, from reception, from in order to receive, and distance ourselves from this aim to ourselves? Why do we afterwards, when we are finally out of it and acquire the property of bestowal, the delighting in mercy, the aim to bestow, why do afterwards we return this corrupted body to ourselves? Call the revival of the dead, something that was dead before, meaning the aim to receive, is renewed. Could the Creator not delight the souls without it? Meaning, is it not enough to reach the degree of Bina? Delighting in mercy, why do we need to renew the body? Body meaning the will to receive, in order to receive the corrupted body. Even more bewildering is what our sages said, that the dead are destined to rise with their flaws. It's not just that the will to receive rises, but it is revived with all the intentions to receive, the worst intentions possible that exist in it. And why should it be like that? The answer is so that there will not be, say that it is another, that someone will say it is not that body but a different body. This is a very strange answer of our sages, as though someone cares who will say that it is or that, not that body. We must understand why God would mind that they would not be mistaken for another, that for that he would recreate their flaw with their and then would have to cure it. So after the Creator brings them to life with her flaws, he will change her intention from receiving to bestowing. We have to understand why does the Creator say, if someone says that he will, that they will not say it is another. So we don't understand the answer of our sages. Until for that, he will recreate the flaw in them and will have to cure them. So there is a corrupted body. You take all these corrupted intentions in order to receive, you ruin them, you burn them, you hang them, you suffocate them, whatever you want. There are four killings in order to correct the will to bestow. You correct them until they're not in reality anymore. Instead, you acquire the aim to bestow. And after you acquire the aim to bestow, the Creator, what is right? That for that he would recreate their flaw. The Creator recreates these flaws, those precise flaws, and then cures them, meaning corrects them in order to bestow. It is a very strange process. Why do it? But that's not even the question. But why should there be like they were before, meaning the first creation was created corrupted, the goof, the body, and we, through our labor, correct this corrupted creation, we bury it until it rots, and then he recreates that corrupted body, and just as it was before, we create corruption twice, so that they'll not mistake him for another. Why is it so important? Inquiry number 6. Regarding what our sages said, that man is the center of reality, that the upper worlds and this corporal world and everything in them were not created but for him. And that's what our sages said, because they attain the entire reality. And we can see that it's so. So that brings up a question. They obliged man to believe that the world was created for him. Doesn't mean that they made us. I have to take into account that the world was created for me. What does that give me? Will it change my approach? What do I understand about this world that was created for me? It is seemingly hard to grasp that for this trifle human who grasps no more than a wisp of this world's reality, much less of the upper worlds, whose height is immeasurable compared to this world, for this tiny person only for him. In a person in this world, it is not some that we exist in some other worlds after we die or something. No. It talks about here, our existence here. How we live as long as we live. So if we look at ourselves, what connection can we find between ourselves and the entire reality? So it is him, it is for me that the Creator troubled to create everything for him. And also, why should man believe that it is so, and what does he need it for? We don't need it. We have no desires for that. This is the end of the inquiries. We had 5 questions and 6 inquiries. First, we sort out the inquiries and then come to the questions. Of course, these questions are not asked by ordinary people, maybe not even by philosophers, because he's asking not from within the mind of a person in this world, even a great mind in this person. Like there were such abilities to people, to several great ones, the greatest philosophers and researchers in history. These questions are asked from the degree of a Kabbalist, those who rose and attained reality. Attain the Creator, yes, from your acts we know you. They attain the laws because they experienced them and used them. And from that point, he asks. But for him, it's not a question anymore. It's just that from his degree of the end of correction to our degree, there's a ladder of attainments, of revelations. That in every single degree there's a plea, a need, a question about life and a satisfaction, fulfillment, which is a revelation of godliness, the light that permeates the vessel in every degree. all the degrees are attainments of reality. And then he said he wants to give us some kind of collective picture, what we go through, what we attain in this process that we have to go through. So we ask questions in such a way that we wouldn't ask. But in order to not confuse us too much, he asks in a way that is convenient for him to tell us what he wants to tell, the process of spiritual development that he wants to tell us. Of course, he could have added many more preparations in philosophy, from philosophy and science, and people that ordinary questions that ordinary people ask. But all in all, they are all in here, contained in all these questions and inquiries. So, is it clear thus far? I also don't agree with Bala Sulam about these questions and inquiries. So what? If I read on, I'll know why he's doing it this way. He tells me about the Creator. I don't know what it is. He tells me I have to believe that the world was created for me. Do I have to? So I'll say yes from now on. So do I? Or whatever you say here, I don't know, revival of the dead. Well, okay, I heard someone said talked about it once. So what? Does that make it a reality for me? If someone said or wrote, do I have to accept it? Can I accept it as something real? I'm an ordinary person. So some sages said, so what? Does that make it a fact for me? That's how you teach beasts, you know, ordinary people. All the questions are like that, that I don't understand. I'm not asking myself about these things. I don't need these inquiries, I don't need these questions. The most I ask is why I feel bad. But when he asks these degrees, but he wants to say that for an ordinary person who just lives like we do, who doesn't care for who's not such a philosopher, yes, who's not Plato or Aristotle. No, I just live my life, and I have no questions like that. But what he wants to say is that I must inquire them in order to reach my own purpose, even as an ordinary person who doesn't want anything from life. Just let me live, you know. No, you will still have to inquire all the operations of the Creator on you in order to reach their solution, the answer, and then you will reach your purpose. That's it, whether you like it or not. From his degree that he attained, that's what he wants to say. We have no choice. It is the obligation of each and every one of us. What does it mean, obligation? Reality is built in such a way that it will compel me to do that. So he wants to explain to me what this reality compels me to do. So what you find here in these questions is something that I face whether I like it or not, because I exist in this world. It's not that I'm interested in that or not interested. You can close the book. But you're alive, you're in this world, it's before you. That's it. And he asks in such a way that neither I nor you would ask them this way. But that doesn't liberate us from going through these things. We'll have to do it anyway. And in a way that he's going to present it to us now. Not the way we think. So I have no choice. I must understand these inquiries and questions, and from that I will understand what is before me necessarily. There's no argument about that. There's no question. It's reality.
What?
More questions. What is the Sitra Acha? Sitra Acha, he says, it's something that is the opposite of the Creator, that he has no connection with, on the one hand. On the other hand, he nurtures it, he revives it. So just think, the Creator is benevolent, yes, as it says here, that it is the way of the good to do good. So how could he create something that is completely against him? And not only is it against him, he revives that. So he wants it to live, to be. First of all, no one makes him create this thing, which is the complete opposite of goodness. Second, not only did he create it, he nurtures it. So if he is benevolent, absolutely benevolent, only benevolent, how can it be that he has even a thought or a desire to create something that is opposite to him? Or maybe even if it happened by chance or something, he still nurtures it, keeps contact with it. We understand that if I have contact with something that is opposite to me, so it must mean that there's something about me from those opposite or obscene properties. And also, how could he have created it? Because how can it be that he will think of creating something that is completely opposite to him? He also exists in this oppositeness, because you can't give something that you don't have. So there has to be a prior reason. Or maybe this is completely new. What does it mean, completely new? That before, there is not a thought about it or an act. We don't understand that. That's what he asks about. There's a difference between inquiries and questions, because the questions are essential, and we will understand them through the inquiries. In order to understand the questions, a question, we have to inquire reality, study it. By studying reality, we build inside. It's hard for me to say it, to find the right words. Tools, understandings, definitions, concepts with which we can understand the question and the answer. You can't approach the questions or even understand them, much less understand the answer to them, if not through the inquiry. Inquiry builds me and brings me closer to the degree of the question and its fulfillment. All the questions are vessels, all the answers are fulfillment. There's no other. In the actual reality, that it's how it is. There are only light and vessels. The question is a desire, is a need. And the question is a fulfillment. The inquiries are presented as questions that if I study it and find an answer to it, I thus build the vessel, and in it comes the answer to the question. Let's say a question is a certain degree. In order to reach it, I have to go through many degrees where there are also questions and answers, but those are called inquiries compared to this let's say global question. Yes, what is our essence? Okay. Item 4. In order to understand these questions and inquiries, the trick is to start by looking at the end, that is, at the purpose of creation. Can we look at the purpose of creation at the end of the act? To begin with, he plays with us in a way we don't understand. But he says, let's follow his recommendation, and this way we will be able to work out the problems from end to beginning. And this approach is the correct approach, because if you begin to work out the problems from our place toward the purpose, toward the end, if we do it this way, we always make mistakes because we have nothing to go with. That's what it says, that we can't understand anything halfway, but only from its end, meaning from its purpose, from the goal toward ourselves. Yes, we are at the beginning of the process, and there is the end. And it is clear that there is no act without a purpose. For only the insane can be found to act purposelessly. We can see that in every inquiry of nature. Everything has its own reason, which is the end, which is the goal of every act. There can be an act without a goal. He explains either infants or insane can do that. That all those who are in that situation, their acts do not come by a certain goal that precedes it. Why? Because every act, it doesn't matter if it's spiritual or corporeal, stems from a need. And the satisfaction for that need is called the end, the goal. So in the vessel, the future fulfillment is felt, and for that purpose the vessel works. Otherwise there is no operation. Why? Because I'm made of a will to receive. How can the will to receive move toward anything if it doesn't see that it is satisfied by that? Meaning, he says, you have no operation without a purpose. That comes because of the essence of the will to receive. Yes, that if you move your hand, as he says, from your hand to the table, then there has to be, it has to be clear for you that here on the chair you'll profit more than if your hand is on the table. So there has to be a purpose to every single act. Otherwise, the will to receive itself doesn't exist and cannot do anything without a clear profit. That's the meaning of no act without a purpose. It is the substance of creation. So if that's the case, of course, the Creator that did everything also relates to creation according to a purpose that he determined. I know that there are those who cast over their backs the burden of Torah and Mitzvot, those who do not accept this process and say the Creator has created reality and then left it alone. That because of the worthlessness of the creatures, it is not fitting for the exalted Creator to watch over their petty little ways. Why are there such who think that the Creator was here or left his operation? We learn about that in the article, The Essence of Religion and Its Purpose. In the article, The Peace, where it says that there are several approaches of humanity to godliness. That its nature, he left it, that he works by many ways to us, many gods, meaning, and so on. So here, he relates to just one of these approaches, that there might be a supreme force that created everything but left it. Why? Because he saw that the creation that he created is in a situation that he doesn't want to deal with anymore and be connected with. Yes, watch over their pretty little ways. Indeed, without knowledge they have spoken, for it is not possible to comment on our nothingness and lowliness before we decide that we have created ourselves with all our tarnished natures. So we might say differently. Maybe the Creator created us complete. And we, I don't know who we is, but I don't feel that I did it. But he presents another way of thought. Yes. Let's think this way, from that angle. That we created ourselves and all our properties obscene and corrupted. I don't know what he wants to say, but let's okay, assume. Can it be that this way he doesn't have to answer about the Creator who remains benevolent, knows the purpose and everything, and he did everything right? We are by ourselves corrupted his work. Could we ever do that? Did it ever happen in a situation, in a degree? Well, he means Adam HaRishon and the corruption, but we'll see. Where it was done seemingly against the order of the Creator. But while we decide that the Creator, who is perfect in every way, and the incomplete are us, and if there's anything incomplete, it's our doing, is the one who created and designed our bodies with all their admirable and contemptible attributes. Surely from under the hand of the perfect worker there cannot emerge an imperfect act, since each act testifies to its former performer. What fault is it of a bad garment if some no good tailor made it? So even if you say that we did it, not the Creator, then it still goes back to the Creator because He created us. So, and then all our operations, however you look at them, are returned to Him. So there cannot be corruption in the world and in any situation if it doesn't come from the Creator, directly or indirectly. Such as this we find in a Talmud, a tale about Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Shimon. Yes, you know him, Rabbi Elazar. We know that he speaks always from the perspective of the end of correction. That Rabbi Elazar always looks at things from the end of correction. So, a person came before Rabbi Elazar who was very, very ugly, meaning very, very bad properties and vices. He told him, "How ugly is that man?" The man replied, "Go and tell the craftsman who made me. How can it be that I'm ugly if the one that made me thought that I'll be ugly, and maybe he wants his things, so you go and tell him. How ugly is this instrument that you have made? Go and tell him." So if we from within our corruptions turn to the Creator, hence those who claim that because of our nothingness and lowliness it is not fitting for him to watch over us, that he left us because we have such properties, and therefore he has left us, do nothing more than publicly display their ignorance, because they say that the Creator is not benevolent, that he is not complete, that he is not eternal, because he doesn't see from reality from end to end, because he doesn't contain at least some individual forces. So their preliminary perspective when they started talking about the Creator as one complete, eternal, benevolent power, that cannot hold if we determine that creation is despicable and low and transient and corrupt. But is it or is it not such? It seems it is. So how do we reconcile this contradiction? Try and imagine if you met some man, not the Creator, but a person who would create creatures precisely so that they would suffer and agonize their whole lives, as we do. And not only that, but cast them behind his back. Not wanting even to look after them. Yes, create them and leave them and throw them to suffer, and that's it. Without any purpose and result and help. To help them a little. How contemptible and how you would regard him. How low you would regard him. Can such a thing be thought of him? So we are still asking, how should we relate to the Creator? If we feel ourselves, in a word, screwed up. And we see that this entire reality is like that. So how should we relate to the Creator? The same way. If there's something wrong with me, it's wrong with him. Go to the craftsman who made me. So this doesn't reconcile. This doesn't connect. So we're still left with the question. But we see the contradiction between philosophers that say that he was here, he did it and left it. So if it's eternal, it can't do that. Therefore, common sense dictates that we grasp the opposite of what appears to us on the surface, meaning don't believe your own eyes. That's what it's trying to say. And decide that we are truly noble and worthy creatures. But it's not like that. Well, let's assume it is. If the Creator is complete and created us, then we too must be complete as he is. And if I don't see or do see, let's leave it aside. Of immeasurable importance, actually worthy of the worker who made us. For if you wish to find faults in our bodies, then behind all the excuses that you give yourself, it falls only to the Creator, who created us and the nature within us. For it is clear that He created us and not we. So let's say that we are complete, eternal, good, everything, like Him. He also knows all the ways that stem from the nature and attributes He created in us. It is, as we've said, that we have to contemplate the end of the act. Then we will be able to understand it all. And the saying goes, do not show a fool an unfinished work. So it's like some kind of an exercise. Let's look at everything as existing perfectly. Everything is perfect. Everything is at the end of correction. There's nothing corrupt. Let's look at creation only this way. And then we'll see where it appears different. And why? It's a problem. That's why the world cannot approach these examinations correctly. Because we all examine from the beginning of creation, from our side, not from its end. As he says that we have to examine from the perfect state, that from our part it's like the end of the way. Of course, we still don't understand how it is possible. We have no approach for that. We have no vessels and understandings what it is in the end. What do I get by saying that it's all perfect? What does that give me? But there can be such a postulate. So we can continue with it. We also see by things that happen in this world that it is impossible that there is any act that is not, that its result is not clear. There is no such act. On the contrary, the more we find nature, we discover nature, we see that the act is a result of a decision and of the conclusion, and the complete situation already exists, and only then do we begin to attain it, perceive it in reality. That's what it happens. That's how it happens in nature in every single way. There's no such thing like Darwinism, when we don't know how something happens, it just happens. But the goal precedes the acts that bring to it. That's why this approach to see everything at the end is very healthy. It enables us to not make mistakes opposite to other approaches that we do err in, because we begin to research and we don't know where we're going. We're just in midair. We don't know where the stream will take us. It is the same approach as the end of the act and a preliminary thought. It is not a philosophical approach, because the philosophers are not at the end. They have no attainment. They cannot say that this is what I see. This is what happens in real life. This is the Creator. That's us at the end of the process. That's how it is. Philosophers don't reach that situation, so they cannot approach it from that angle. And they have great minds, special minds. They were at the border of spiritual attainments. Even Kabbalists write that. But they didn't have the attainment of the purpose, and for that reason their approach was lame and produced methods that until today produce no correct conclusion. They admit it. That's why philosophy ended. The philosophical question, the basic one, is what is our essence? And it ended because it is not following the end of the act is in the preliminary thought. And in Kabbalah, we learn that it, with one thought, with one desire, in one act, the entire creation was created. Yes, it is an inner reflection of part one of Talmud Yisrael Sfirot. It is in the inner reflection of part one in Talmud Yisrael Sfirot. She writes in item 8 of the inner reflection. With one thought, the entire reality was emanated and created, and that is that works, and that is the essence of the work, and that is the reality of the desired reward and the essence of the labor, all in one thought. As we say, the first situation, third situation, everything exists to begin with. Only the second situation doesn't exist. The first is a beginning of creation. The third is the end of creation. And the second is when we discover creation. So the second creation is what we have to find. In order to find creation, we feel ourselves opposite to its purpose. But creation itself was created by the Creator only in one way. With one thought, it was created and emanated in acts, and it is the essence of the act, the reward, and it is the essence of the work. Everything is in it. What preceded the thought of the creation to create the creatures? We can't study that in the meantime because we don't belong to a higher root. After we reach the end of correction, we incorporate with the Creator, reach His degree, and then begin to study and understand the prior thoughts, but not right now. What Kabbalists write to us in the Zohar is all written from the Zohar. Doesn't relate to the first restriction at all, only to the second restriction, from the world of Atzilut and below, after the breaking of the vessels. It relates only to the corrections. Baal HaSulam and the Ari, well, actually the Ari discovered first restriction, not discovered but exposed, or revealed it. Before him, you can't say that the Kabbalists revealed it. Rabbi Shimon, you can't say that he didn't know about it, but only the Ari wrote about it, and after that it was studied and written about. You see how much Baal HaSulam writes until he reaches the breaking of the vessels. Or the vessels, yes. Six parts of Talmud is restored. But still, what he does write, he writes only that which belongs to the second restriction, and things that will afterwards become operations in the second restriction and afterwards. because otherwise we can't understand. We haven't the perception of how limited we are. Ourselves, our mind, our emotions, our hearts are all built by the second restriction, the combinations of Malchut and Bina. And we have no we can't touch the second restriction. It is beyond the end of correction. The breaking starts only from the second restriction and below. The breaking is on the second restriction, on the connection between Malchut and Bina. That this connection seemingly failed, and we have to do it right through our work. And afterwards, when we build the right connection between Malchut and Bina, then the stony heart is corrected, which is the difference between the first and second constriction restrictions, and we reach the first restriction, and then we can already study what is above it. But that's not something Kabbalists write about. There are no words there. There are no letters. Our language doesn't help us, because our vessels are only according to the second restriction. Our words are signs. We have no signs that depict the first restriction. We can't convey what we feel. So they have some means of expressing something of it. It is called the secret scrolls. But still, we will not understand it. I have such writings of Bala Sulam, original ones. He writes words we don't understand what they mean. He writes names, word after word, word by word. Those are not operations we study in Talmud Sefirot. Other than beside the reality that we Kabbalists tell us about in their books, beside that, there's another 99% of reality they don't tell us about, because we don't need it. He tells us about demons, ghosts, and angels, and forces that act, but he doesn't tell us about all that. He doesn't tell us about how to correct the still vegetative and animate, how all the souls are corrected. There are many questions. In their writings, they don't explain to us, but only that which belongs to a very, very narrow angle toward us, so that we draw the lights and become corrected through the lights. And then from them we will know. Through them we will know. There's no other way. Someone who thinks he knows Talmud Esel Sfirot, he might know it by heart, but if he doesn't attain, it's just a machine. It doesn't give him anything. And second, even if you know it by heart, it is a tiny part compared to what actually exists. Well, we'll continue tomorrow.